time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
If Spencer Rattler wants to transfer, he's got plenty of cars to drive him there.
Pete Thamel.
If you are a bottom half of a Power 5 league, it's like a 90% chance you are not going to go through your season with one starting quarterback.
With SI's Pat Forty.
The first premise of Kirk Ferentz football is thou shalt not beat thyself.
Here's Pat, Pete, and Dan.
Welcome to the pod overreaction Monday, and we have so much to overreact to, we could overreact until Tuesday. Someone asked you why you love college football. This was it. From noon till night, till 3 a.m. or whatever, when UCLA kind of pulled away in the fourth quarter, and there may have been one later than that. Wasn't for me. Unbelievable day of college football. And there are so many games that it just was impossible to get through. You know, massive victories across the board. I mean, by the time A&M and Bam are going at it, like the Arkansas Ole Miss game, which was a classic, felt like it was like 3 weeks ago. Might as well have been talking about Arkansas and A&M. Just unbelievable moment. You know, the big result, obviously, is A&M. I don't know what they were doing. Imposters during the first 5 weeks of the season when they weren't any good. Team scores 10 points against Colorado, 10 points against Arkansas, loses to Mississippi State, and then hangs 41 on Bama. And then I thought, not only that, finishes with the last 10. Bama essentially collapses. They cannot stop them on two straight drives and goes three and out. Absolute gag job by the Crimson Tide, which you never saw coming. First loss to an unranked team in 100 games. I would argue A&M is not really your classic unranked team that's underperforming. And then the great moment of when Seth Small kicks the final field goal at the end, and it heads directly left, full on hook, like a bad tee shot. And then out of nowhere, curves back. You see that thing? Like that thing was, I was like, oh no, he made it. I was like, I always root for the kicker. Generally, like, I don't care who wins between A&M and Alabama. I'm just watching. And I'm like, I do not want to see this kid blow the game in front of, at that point, probably an audience of 10 million, 100,000, you know, like, oh, no. So he hits the field. And I will make right now, I will apologize to the CBS execs that I mocked for taking this game as a primetime. Oh, they cashed their check. They were right. I was wrong. It's wrong about a lot of things. Pat Forty, A&M, Bama, thoughts.
Stunning. I mean, absolutely did not see this coming at all. You know, A&M, as you noted, had just looked like a dysfunctional mess offensively when Haynes King, their starting quarterback, got hurt. Everything collapsed. Zach Calzada had not done much at all. So, you know what? Good for him for the bounce back performance there. A lot of people were on his case about the way he was performing, and then he steps up and has the best performance of his career. 21 of 31, 285, three touchdowns. Phenomenal. But yeah, to me, the big, big shock is that Alabama, after being down, takes the lead, and then gives it back. You just don't see that. You certainly don't expect that from a Nick Saban team, but they absolutely did. They gave the game away at the end. Couldn't stop them. Penalties. It was very surprising. And I will say, Alabama's played two true road games this year, and they're kind of lucky to even be 1-1. They barely beat Florida, had to hang on there, and then they lose to Texas A&M. So you get them on the road in the SEC, and they've still got a couple of road games left, and they look like a good team, but certainly not a great team. And when Alabama loses a game like this, I think everybody around the country is like, whoa, the landscape just shifted.
Yeah, I thought, you know, not only did they blow the lead that they took, but they just looked very uncharacteristic Alabama. Two defenders on a key play on A&M's final drive literally run into each other and fall over like Keystone Cops. That doesn't happen to Alabama in the clutch. There was obviously the pass interference penalty, which I thought was the big play. That really took them from like, oh no, college kicker field goal range to even the three of us could make it field goal range. Although, as Dan noted, he did. There was that. Oh, okay. moment there. And then you think to the Billingsley drop on the final Alabama drive, like Alabama's sort of fait accompli move it victory. I think they just went three and out in that drive, which there was Young threw behind somebody. But the Billingsley drop was like, and even Saban said it after the game on his Zoom, like we were ready to go into 2 minute and we were ready to go. And that was to get a 2 minute offense going. You have to get that first down, right? You have to get that first push and then go. And they literally were just stopped in their tracks and had to punt. Zach Calzada was a overmatched backup quarterback against Arkansas and against Mississippi State and flashed next to nothing that showed he could be a high-end SEC starter slash Alabama giant killer. And good for that kid, man. He locked in, and it was fun to see him on the field after the game celebrating like that. He delivered, you know, a historic moment. No matter whatever happens to his career, he will have that night in that moment. He can sign t-shirts in the bookstore and go to the weird yell night and be a hero. That's the night that undefeated Alabama went to College Station and lost. I think it was the first loss to an unranked team for a number one since USC lost to Oregon State back in the Pete Carroll era. I mean, just a huge access shifting night.
Look, Alabama wins out there. They win the national championship. If Alabama never loses again, they're going to win the national championship. So their path, I think, is still right there. They went out. A&M has got two losses in the league. This loss, you know, has no impact on Alabama. So there is that. But this was an Alabama team and great win for A&M and great effort. They played so hard. That crowd was incredible. They, I don't know how many false starts, different stuff that happened in that game. They rattled Bama. It was incredible. That pseudo army they have was out.
The Pirates. Pseudo army.
The Pirates.
That's what Leach used to call them, the Pirates.
Yeah. He said, we can't create our. Wasn't that when he became a Pirate?
Okay.
Someone look up that old quote. I think he just said, I'm going to name it. If you just say you're an army, but you're not, it's like the Salvation Army, right? It's like, you're not really an army. It's not what that's about. But like, I don't know. They're always in their dress garbs. There were guys with swords on the sideline. Like, what is that? Like, I get like the New England Patriots. They got the Minutemen with the guns after. Okay, you know, shoot a cannon off. So there's some military aspects. I'm fine. Like, that was weird. Like, you guys look ready for battle. Like, who's, is there going to be a sword fight? I don't know. They're going to carve
it's
up that
one
big,
of the stranger places in college.
I don't know what, there's an army. Yeah. We have our own branch of the military here. But it doesn't matter. Great night. I don't want to know what's going on in that the depths of Central Texas or wherever that thing is. All right. Alabama, there were these moments where they looked like Alabama. The block punt. Like, when they got the block punt for a touchdown, and got that down to 24-17. I'm like, here we go. And I would bet a solid 50% of A&M fans, if not more, were like, we're going to lose the game.
Oh, sure.
But then they give up a kickoff, you know, but then they start getting down. They're driving the ball. But they hold A&M to three and out, four and out, three and out. But they get to the red zone, can't get in. Field goal in the middle of that. But they take the lead and then just boom. This is, I thought Alabama was going to win the game, obviously, until the very end, especially, you know, the injury and all that. So I'm thinking Alabama's going to win, but I'm like, this is a fun deal. Watch. It's like the Florida game. It's fun to watch Alabama in a fight. You guys probably did not watch the Wilder Fury heavyweight fight after, but it was phenomenal heavyweight fight because both guys got knocked down multiple times. It's like, this is what you want. Like, there's Alabama is not the juggernaut this year. They can win the rest of their games, win the national title. I would not be surprised, but they've got to earn it this year. They ain't just walking into places and just kicking the hell out of them. So it was really fun. I'm like, okay, this is what the season's going to be about. Other than Georgia, I have no faith that anyone's just rolling through anything. It is going to be a dogfight throughout. So fascinating. Bama needs work. They have everything in front of them, though.
I brought this up in takeaways today, Dan, and I think it sort of should at least enter the conversational lexicon. I'm not saying it's going to happen. Alabama could lose two games and go to the playoffs. If they went out and lose to Georgia. Like, I think we have to, like, wrap our mind around the potential of a two-loss team being in this CFP conversation. Like, we've obviously reference that delightfully zany 2007 season a bunch of times when LSU was undefeated in regulation, but lost two overtime games and ended up like the world went sideways on its head and they ended up in the final two, which was just insane. And that at least has to like be a possibility right now. I mean, Iowa's great. We'll get to them. They could certainly lose a game. You know, they could pick a Big Ten West team and they could fall to them at some juncture. So then all of a sudden you're like, one loss Iowa, you know, or Iowa wins out and loses to Ohio State in the title game. Then I just think that two loss Alabama could become a factor at some point.
That would be interesting. I mean, it's not out of the question. Nothing's out of the question at this point. I mean, we've seen enough turbulence and enough upset losses that, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, theoretically, sure. You know, it will be obviously very interesting to see not just what the pollsters do with Alabama, but when we finally get around to having a selection committee ranking. If Alabama's still sitting there with one loss, where are they in relation to other one-loss teams? Are they automatically the highest because they're Alabama, or where are they if Ohio State's still sitting there with one loss, if Oregon, which beat Ohio State on its own field, is still sitting there with one loss, you know, how do you order those teams? That's going to be fairly important, I think. And there's a lot of sorting still to go, but the Big Ten, especially in the East, presents those teams, all of them, with a lot of chances for quality wins against highly ranked opponents. If somebody can get through that, and it's like October 30th, November 27th, Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State, Penn State all play each other in that five Saturday block. If somebody can get through that without losing, or if they only, you know, if the winner of the Big Ten East only has one loss going into the postseason, they're going to be a major factor there, and we may end up, who knows, with two Big Ten teams in the conversation. But a lot to play out.
What about this one? Let's say it's Michigan is unbeaten playing Ohio State with one loss. Ohio State wins the game, then goes on and wins the Big Ten. What about Michigan would be sitting there at 11-1?
Yeah.
And have a whole bunch of quality wins you could compare to, you know, something like that. So it's to a two-loss Bama team. You know, and again, these things all come down. The one thing Alabama has going for it, it's the proverbial, what if you lose on a last-second field goal on the road?
Right.
It's an understandable loss. But still, they lost.
Yeah.
So that will be wild. I don't know if a two-loss can get in. They'll need a lot of help. But there's a lot out there still.
Oh, yeah.
Including three unbeaten Big Ten teams at this stretch. We got to move on. We have so many games. Red River. Largest comeback in Red River history. 21 points. This was absolutely a bonkers game. This is why we're all last week, no one wanted to pick the Red River because it's just chaos. And that spread is just, it's irrelevant. Like something's going to happen that's going to mock the spread, which happened, by the way. But we'll start with this. Oklahoma, Spencer Rattler, terrible to start. They dropped by 21. In comes Caleb Williams. Turns out the student section at Oklahoma knew what they were talking about. They must have been sneaking in to watch practice. He rallies them. They outscore Texas 35-10 with Caleb Williams in there. But then Rattler comes back for the critical two-point conversion to make it 41-41. What does Rafter call them, onions? That is an onion substitution of Ivar. What? I was like, wait, is Rattler back in? What is going on? He converts it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And then this game had six touchdowns of 30 or more by both teams combined. Six, including Kennedy Brooks, 33 yards with 1 second left to basically walk off and win the game. And screw the point spread. If you just tackle them, Texas, and make them kick the field goal, some of us leave happy.
Yeah.
We might have had the same betting on Texas. There, I hate them. They have no heart. I can't stand betting on Texas. God. Come just tackle them. Don't let them score a touchdown. I'm sitting there going, this is going to be great. Kick the field goal. I don't want overtime.
Kennedy not Brooks. Only did
incredible
they not,
run.
Not I only mean, did they not tackle him, I'm not sure they really even got a hand on him or a hit on him. You know, I was just kind of like, oh, there he goes. Oh, gee. Oh, gosh. Oh, well.
When have you seen a game end on a 33-yard walk-off run when all the guy's doing is trying to kill clock for the field goal?
Right.
The only thing crazier, and we're going to get to it, is Iowa taking victory formation when they couldn't,
when they couldn't run, even the, run clock out the clock.
I'm going to get to that, though. All right. Caleb Williams, 15 to 24, 211 yards, two TDs, four carries, 88 yards, one TD. Spencer Rattler, 9 of 16, 112, one inch, and two sacks. Okay. Caleb Williams was phenomenal. True freshman out of Washington, D.C. area. He has lived up to the hype. Pete, who is Rattler done here? Will they just revolt and overturn and burn the Sooner schooner in Norman if Spencer Rattler's back out there as the starter the rest of the way?
Again, Lincoln Riley has forgotten more about quarterback play today than I ever have in my life. But it seemed pretty obvious who the best quarterback at Oklahoma is yesterday. This is the second year in a row Spencer Rattler has been benched in the Red River game for just simply not playing well. And Caleb Williams went and seized the day with the stakes the biggest, down 28-7, rolls in on a fourth and one on the first play of the second quarter, and just blitzes through the Texas defense for a 66-yard run. Caleb Williams was everything Spencer Rattler hasn't been in some of these big games. He's been poised. He's collected. He's accurate. He didn't make fatal mistakes. I don't see any way that Spencer Rattler gets his job back. I think it's fairly obvious. And I think Lincoln Riley's histrionics of not letting Williams do the post-game interview and not saying right away like what they're going to do going forward is the biggest tip of his hand. Like, he's trying to manage that situation within his locker room. And I mean, by dinner time on Saturday, I had coaches texting me, think he goes to Georgia after JT Daniels goes? Think Rattler goes to, one of the Arizona schools where he's from? Do you think he goes to Texas A&M? Like people are already, this is college football. People are already wondering where Spencer Rattler will transfer to next year. And that's just the sport we're in. Maybe it's Miami where he takes over for De'Aaron King. That's the reality of Spencer Rattler. I don't think there's any NFL market for him. And we've said this on the show a few times. We've been pretty Spencer Rattler skeptical, I think, our listeners here. And we've been pretty bullish on Caleb Williams, too. Caleb Williams, to me, is a quarterback of the talent who can pick up that Oklahoma lineage that we've seen under Lincoln Riley. Now, it's not fair to say he's going to be the number one pick in the draft, right? But he is going to be a high-end Big 12 quarterback, like, who can eventually develop into someone who can run that offense like a maestro and keep Oklahoma a step ahead of everyone else. I think we saw the first flash of that today, and I've gotten to know Caleb Williams a bit through doing some stories on him in high school. You spent 10 minutes around that kid, it's a no-brainer that he's going to just be on a rocket ship to start him.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Caleb Williams is the quarterback going forward. I wouldn't be surprised if Rattler tries to go pro. You know, he's a draft eligible, and he's draft eligible, and he's got a reputation. I mean, what were people saying coming into the season? I don't think they were saying it accurately, but they were saying he was going to be the top quarterback in the draft. That was what people were saying. Based on what? I don't know, because I watched him last year and he wasn't that good. But that's what people were saying over and over and over. So if you've been hearing that basically since you're 17 years old, you're an NFL quarterback, it's hard to get that thought out of your head. So we'll see what he does. But
fifth quarterback at a training camp? Like, he's not even a live arm for camp work.
Maybe not. But I you know what? This is more of a basketball equivalency, but how many guys have gone pro? We weren't going to get drafted, you know?
Those guys, yes, but then they can go play other places.
Yeah.
Like football, you're out.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing, going to Canada? Like, half the league is, almost everyone in the league now played in the G League.
Right.
And you see these stories of these guys, and it's like, I was in Italy, and I was in Serbia, and I was in Australia, and I was in Israel, and I was in the Rio Grande, whatever, fighting ants, and then I'm up on it, and then it's like, I got a 10-day contract, and boom.
Yeah.
If Spencer Rattler wants to transfer, he's got plenty of cars to drive him there. Two cars
for the second-string quarterback.
Peace out, Norman. I took you for everything you got.
Yeah.
You know what this Rattler situation is indicative of, and I think it underscores something really, really important, and we've seen it with Bram Mertz and a couple others this year. Your ranking in high school is really important because that can carry you past actual bad performance. I mean, Pat mentioned basketball. I was thinking the same thing. How many five-star guys? Now, some of these guys are 7-1, and there's only so many humans walking the earth that are 7-1. But in football now, you are getting a pass for performance if you had the hype. And that ranking that you get early and you cultivate and you go to the camps and you have the right tutors, that stuff's important, like in terms of the bottom line for Spencer Rattler, in terms of the bottom line for, I mean, Graham Mertz got a ton of NIL deal. He's not great, right? He's just a guy right now. But the reason why we don't, the look on Pat's face, the reason why we think of him through a different prism is because of the recruiting rankings. And the recruiting rankings, at the very least right now, are a key to wealth in a different level platform. And we have seen brands go after guys with high recruiting rankings who may not have been productive. Now, that may adjust as we go forward here. There's been a little bit of like a new car scent to this NIL stuff, right? Like everybody kind of wants to jump in and give it a shot. Yeah, get your stars, boys. That's gonna get you some dough.
Yeah,
the payoffs now need to be to the recruiting rankers.
Yeah, right.
Pay those guys off.
No kidding.
I need a 5-star. Yeah, there's man, your, and I will your, cut you in. I'll cut you in on 2% of my future stuff.
Right.
Your that would never happen at Rivals, which is owned by Yahoo, but I would imagine that's happened somewhere along
the other places. Guys are the best.
Our guys
are actually the best.
They're really good. Yes. That was not a knock on Rivals. No. That was just there has been some either information exchange, like the recruiting rankings over the years. There's some coaches who will famously call and lobby for guys.
Sure.
There's a fairly famous story of a coach calling to lobby for like a Heisman Trophy caliber guy. And he was like, right. But the people at the recruiting places were like, well, he also called about these three guys who stunk too. Because the coaches' bonuses are tied to it. Why wouldn't they? Like,
sure.
You know, hey, help us out here. We're going to help you out with, you know, where, when he visits. And
Guys get a bonus if you recruit a top five star, you know, like you recruit a five-star player. I don't know about now. They used to have those.
Yeah.
All right, let me get to this.
Randy
about
Edsel
Caleb
gets
Williams.
A bonus if 5-star well, show true. Up in the sky over store still. So.
Well, they don't. Caleb Williams represents this, and this will lead into our next game. You need a second quarterback. And it's really hard to keep a second quarterback on your campus because you can transfer at the drop of a hat. So Calzada, right? That's your second string quarterback. You got injuries, so he's playing. Caleb Williams comes in, or they are getting boat raced in the Red River. Notre Dame wins a knife fight with Virginia Tech because Tyler Buckner comes in. They're freshmen. And at least settles it down before Cohn comes back. You need that extra guy. Penn State, game you were at, Pat, are in Iowa City. Once Sean Clifford goes down, Taquan Roberson comes in. 7 of 21 for 34 yards. They is some of the missing open players by 5 yards. Just zero chance. Zero chance. Penn State does not have a second quarterback. Their second quarterback is Will Levis, who's down at Kentucky, drinking mayo coffee and going 6-0 and pounding on LSU, throwing 3 touchdowns, right? So this is the problem, because a guy like Will Levis would have been your second string quarterback, perhaps, and Penn State's going to win that game, maybe. Instead, it's like, why am I sticking around? I go to Kentucky and I'm here. Like, it is so hard. You need two quarterbacks. And if you don't have one, you only have one, you could be in a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. I mean, I've rarely, if ever, seen a more vivid example than what I watched in Kinnick Stadium, where Sean Clifford was, he did throw 2 interceptions, but he was playing well. I mean, he was moving them up and down the field against a really good defense. They had 3 scoring drives in their first 5 possessions. He's running the ball, and the whole game plan was, we got to throw it 45 times because we can't run against these guys. And so you've got to have a quarterback who can throw. And Clifford was dealing, and he was getting it done. And when he went down, like, not just did Roberson struggle with throwing the ball, but just getting the team lined up and getting a playoff. I mean, that was the shocking thing, is when Roberson came in, from that point on, for the rest of the game, Penn State had 8 false starts. At one point, they had 3 in a row on the first drive that Roberson was in there. And this, it was amazing, really, to watch the crowd impact a game the way they did. This is a very tight stadium. There's very little room between the stands and the field, and you could just literally feel and see the fan noise pressing on Penn State and turning them into jelly. And I mean, you talk about a quarterback who was deer in the headlights and took his team down with him, God help him. That's what happened. It was astounding, really. And yeah, you know what? Penn State's the kind of program where you would think the backup quarterback's pretty good. Now, the backup quarterback is the starter at Kentucky, and they're 6-0 for the first time since Bear Bryant was the coach. So that happened. But still, there's got to be, you would think, somebody else there who you've either can coach up or that can go in who's got the ability to run plays so that you have a chance in a game of that magnitude. And look, Iowa was lucky that they knocked Clifford out, but they knocked Clifford out. That's defense and that's physical football. You know, you hit the quarterback until the quarterback either doesn't want to play or can't play, and they knocked him out of that game, and that gave him the chance there. So they sure, there's not many places that have a Caleb Williams sitting on the bench, you know. And I mean, the play to me where I was like, oh my God, this guy is a superstar, is when he stepped up and threw the 52-yard bomb to Marvin Mims. I mean, incredible pass off of 1 foot, and Mims' incredible catch. If there's one play, I can't fault Texas for – I can fault Texas defense for 4,000 things in that game, but not that play. That was just a great quarterback and a great receiver making a play. Everybody wishes they had even a half of Caleb Williams on the bench right now.
So the most compelling character to me late Saturday all of a sudden became Blake Bost, right? Zach Calzada goes into the injury tent. He looked hurt. Like, he limped off the field. His knee looked hurt. And then all of a sudden, it's a true freshman walk-on from Groves, Texas, Port Neches Groves High School. Now, I, like, immediately went to his Rivals profile. He had, like, offers from Incarnate Word and Austin Peay. So he wasn't, like, you know, some guy who just they pulled out of the Yale call or whatever. He seemingly was decent. But can you imagine? I actually, before Calzada walked out of the injury tent. Remember, Jimbo was so concerned. He went into the injury tent. I don't know if I've ever seen a head coach go into the injury tent to check on a player.
Is he coaching up the medical personnel there?
Whatever. Whatever got done in there, that was like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, because that was like, he's out. Next thing you know, he's good.
We're 0 for 24 against this guy for a reason, Calzada. Let's go.
They called that the Texas A&M Army medic. He got in there. They got special.
So can you imagine, like, having gone to high school with Blake Bost, and you're sitting there on Saturday night in your freshman dorm room having a Bush Light and watching A&M and be like, oh my God, my buddy's about to go in the game. Like that.
Alabama. Oh no.
Oh, by the way, all you have to do is march down the field and beat Alabama. No big deal, Blake. Like, but there is, like, it was a great point by Dan. Like, remember Gardner Minshew was a minute away from going to Alabama as a backup. He got promised a GA spot, and he was going to go into coaching. And Gardner Minshew ended up going to Washington State, became an NFL quarterback, and he's a perfectly viable backup quarterback in the National Football League. That speaks to me to Saban being a step ahead. Not that he knew Minshew would be this good, but coaches are going to try to find older roster players and keep them around as viable backups going forward. There is a huge market. If you are a 21-year-old who's been in a college system for 3-4 years, there's a robust market for you because you are needed, because you have to live. Like at Ohio State right now, like everyone's wondering, well, where's Jack Miller going to go? Kyle McCord going to stick around? Like, that's just the way the game is being played right now. It's a free market, and it's created a market inefficiency for dependable backup quarterbacks.
Zeb Nolan.
Let me say this. I also want to add JT Daniels and Stetson Bennett at Georgia.
Absolutely. Right?
Well, if you don't have Stetson Bennett, maybe you drop one of those games. You know, he's so this is my thing, and this is what we predicted when the world was going to end because you could transfer, or the world was going to end because it's NIL. It spreads out the talent. The famous one I always make fun of was when poor old Ohio State had to go to their third string quarterback, and it was Cardale Jones who was going to play in the NFL. It's not like you have a stiff as your third string quarterback at these levels. Well, now you might, because some kid's going, hey, I can make money. I can start. I can transfer in league now. That always made, you know, you remember they used to block them? You know, if you were Florida State, you might not be able to go anywhere. Closest school you can go to is Colorado State. You know, they do anything they could to try to come up with these crazy things.
We scheduled Georgia in 2029. You can't go there.
Right. Somehow, every other sport, like the NFL, you can get cut and picked up in the your next week's opponent in 1 minute. But there's no way for college. He will give us the secrets for that game 3 years from now. Now you can transfer in the league. So this is going to continue. Kids aren't going to sit and be third string. You're looking at the Will Levis story. Will Levis would have been backup QB at Penn State, or he is right now like the king of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Good choice. Besides the NIL. So the sport should get flatter. Now, I'm not going to say it's flat, but it should get flatter. And this is what we're talking about when a school like Penn State has one guy. They can't stockpile, and their guys are running elsewhere. And you said Ohio State's got four right now. They're going to have four by the end of the year. And you also, the coach that works these backups and maybe gets them in games as many as possibly can or finds a role. You see Jim Harbaugh finding a role for his talented freshman. You're going to run. We're going to get you in games. Huge part of this sport right now, because you just can't sit back and be like, I got a 4 or 5 star in every recruiting class. They'll all wait their turn.
There's a statistic I've been told that's completely unverified, but very believable, that if you are a bottom half of a Power 5 league, it's like a 90% chance you are not going to go through your season with one starting quarterback, meaning like that dude's going to go under assault. And at some point, like, you're going to have to start the backup. Like, yeah, the backup conundrum is like one of the most fascinating roster buildup, roster building dynamics going forward in the sport, because they are important.
Well, that's where you look.
Wait your turn or get an opportunity.
Yeah, that's why it's a good use for your staff of 67 analysts and GAs and assistants and everything like that, is just to be constantly scouring the landscape. Where are we going to get our next quarterback or our next backup quarterback? You know, there are people that their job is basically just to look for potential transfers out there. And that's the way of the world right now.
But it's hard to convince a guy at the end of his career to go take a job where you have no guarantee to play. I think it's easier to say, hey, listen, you've already done, let's say you're the QB, let's say you lose the job, I don't know, some NC State, some mid-level league, and you got a year or two left, and one guy's saying, hey, come here and we might get you in a game at Alabama. That's tempting. Might win a national championship, you might get. But you know what? If Marshall's saying, I'll make you the starter the next 2 years. And, you know,
that's. Or Wisconsin in that scenario.
Or Wisconsin, right. Or, right. Penn State to Kentucky. It's hardly like a big step. You know, I mean, Penn State's football program is much more renowned than Kentucky's, but it's not that big of a step. So it's just, I don't know. It's going to be very, very interesting. All right. I want to talk about Iowa, though, quickly. They are 6-0. They have Purdue. They are at Wisconsin. They are at Northwestern. They got Minnesota, Illinois, and at Nebraska. Of that, only Purdue and Minnesota have winning records, 3-2 each. Pat, you watch this team. They are blowing out. Well, they blew out Maryland, but they don't blow out many people. It's going to be a rock fight the whole way. But could we see 12-0 Iowa going into the Big Ten? Could they run this table? I mean, they certainly be favored in every one of those games, I would assume. I can't imagine one they're not, unless it's Nebraska. If they got it, I just don't see it. Right? They're going to be favored in every game. They're in good shape.
Yeah. Oh, they're in phenomenal shape. Unbelievable shape. You know, they've got 3 Big Ten wins already. They got the nice non conference win over Iowa State on the road, and they're in the West, which is by far the easier division. So yes, I think it's extremely possible they're 12-0. As you said, like, the margin for error is not luxurious. So you show up and you have a bad day at the wrong time, you could lose to Purdue. You could lose at Wisconsin. You could lose at Nebraska. We'll see. You know, I think Pete was alluding to, is Nebraska in the tank at that point or not? But Nebraska can move the ball and can score. And we'll see if Adrian Martinez drops the ball while he's moving the ball. But, I mean, Nebraska came extremely close to making both Michigan and Michigan State one-loss teams instead of undefeated teams. I mean, they are a dangerous opponent down there at the end of the schedule. You know, the Iowa thing, this is so Kirk Ferentz, it almost hurts. You know, I mean, it is just them doing what they have always done and doing it maybe better than they have ever before, which is, you know, all the old school tenets of football. It is field position. It is turnover margin. It's, you know, defense. It's making sure the other team respects your running game, even if your running game isn't very good, but you're going to continue to do it until you can throw a play action bomb for the winning touchdown against Penn State. It is funny. It's a little bit reassuring, I guess, you know, in a time when everybody out there wants to tell you that you are a coward or a chicken or a loser if you don't go for every fourth down, to see Kirk Ferentz continually get the ball in plus territory on the other side of the 50 and still punt the ball and win a huge game doing that, because he's got a great punter who knocks it down there inside the five and they go cover it. And then the crowd starts going crazy and everything goes Iowa's way at that point. It is a pretty amazing kind of defiance almost of the way football has been going for Kirk Ferentz to just be succeeding wildly in the direction he has. Now, I look at them and I see a lot of their 2015 team, which somehow went 12-0 and darn near 13-0 when they lost a thrilling Big Ten championship game to Michigan State. And then finally in the Rose Bowl got exposed and destroyed by Christian McCaffrey in Stanford. This team could be that team. You could be end up 12-0 and lose by 40 to Ohio State or somebody in the conference championship game, or God forbid you get into the playoff and all of a sudden you play Georgia and lose by 30 because you can't even get past your own 40-yard line, something like that. So look, I give Iowa a ton of credit for getting every single drop they can out of this team, but this team at some point could have a very, very hard reckoning coming if they make it to the playoff.
You know, it has to take a rare occurrence for me to overtly compliment my friend Pat Forty on this podcast, but I do tip my hat, my journalism cap, my fedora to Pat's lead from Iowa City on Saturday night. Quote, when they build the Kirk Ferentz Museum of Fundamental Football here in a drab but sensible building at the corner of Straight and Narrow, they should devote an entire wing to Iowa's 23-20 victory over Penn State Saturday. This was a Louvre-quality exhibition of every basic building block that has made Ferentz a Hall of Fame football coach.
Rack that, Sully. Rack it and keep it for posterity.
That is good. I got one fact check. That building would be just a square. So there would be no wings. Just be square. A section of the windowless building. It'd be like their basketball stadium is dug in that, like, good environmental, right? Keep the heat and cost down. Uh-huh. Okay.
Anyway. If they want to make it nice. Kid friendly, they wouldn't put like grass to throw the ball. They would just put a punting patch in the back.
Yeah, punting. Where's the end zone? Yeah, we just punt.
Yeah. It wouldn't be an end zone to throw touchdowns in. It would be an end zone to cover kicks. That's inside,
right?
The five.
That's right. Downing kicks.
Well, let me say this about the punt. This is one of the most remarkable stretches of football I've ever seen. Iowa is leading by 3. 23-20. They get the ball on an interception, right? They immediately, with 2:18 left, Penn State has one timeout. They go into victory formation. Take a knee for 1 yard loss. Penn State burns its final timeout at 2:13. Same thing, 3 yard loss, then a 3 yard loss. They finally call timeout. And I'm watching the game and I'm looking, going, wait a minute, how is the clock going to run out here? There's too much time. And I'm like, maybe I'm an idiot and I can't figure out the clock. But this doesn't compute to me. And I'm like, well, maybe I'm confusing the NFL time. I'm all confused. Sure enough, they have to punt the ball with 46 seconds left. They did 3 victory formations at the Penn State. Like, they were at the 40-yard line of Penn State. Rather than run plays and try to kick a field goal to ice the game or drive in for a touchdown, they victory formationed before you could victory formation so they could punt it one last time, okay, and leave Penn State with 32 seconds left, and all they need is a field goal. Now, the crazy part is because it's Kirk Ferentz and because it's Iowa and because Penn State's backup QB was bad, it made sense. Like, this would have been the worst coaching decision in the history of coaching decisions.
It was.
The idiot went for a victory formation when victory wasn't assured. Yet, because of its circumstances, you're like, it's kind of smart.
Look, the first premise of Kirk Ferentz football is thou shalt not beat thyself. And if you run the ball, you may fumble. So don't fumble. And yes, the second part of the equation, obviously, is the fact that Penn State's quarterback had shown no ability to complete enough passes to get them in field goal range. So you do what you do. You kick it down there deep. You get the crowd on top of them, and you watch Penn State melt down one more time. It was perfect Kirk Ferentz football.
Penn State got it at the 8, but all they had to do was they only needed a field goal. They chose to give them the ball back. It's incredible.
Yeah, and they weren't on like the minus 10. That was the part that was remarkable about it. Like, they didn't have to go very far to get a field goal. They were, what, 15 yards from field goal range? I wonder when the last time Iowa...
They're at the 40-yard line. Penn State's 40.
I wonder when the last time Iowa had a punt blocked. Like, that has to go into the calculus here, right?
Yeah.
Who is the last team to block an Iowa punt? I have
Whoever's responsible is subject to execution in the state of Iowa. It's in the bylaws, it's in the Constitution. They wrote it into the Constitution of Iowa, so no future politician could rewrite it. Yeah, no.
We need to at least quickly ask Pat if he did go to Ames to try the tap. He was just 35 minutes away.
Yeah. No, I let down the pod. I did not go to Ames for the tap. The Des Moines tap was very good. I did have some of that. And I have to say, you know, I mean, I think the runoff from if it runs from Ames north to Des Moines, it's all good. So
it was an enjoyable toothbrush this morning.
Like, very good.
You got up and just crisp.
All of
on
my
the
interactions with the Des Moines tap water have been very positive.
Okay. All right. Well, it's not far. It's probably the same, you know, aquifer or something like that. Yeah. Who knows? All right. Staying in that region of the country, Michigan goes to Nebraska. And if everyone wasn't watching A&M Alabama, this would have been this is a classically great game. It was a great game. Lead changes. Michigan, hats off to Nebraska as just an environment for football. It's just phenomenal. 13-0, they're losing at half, and the fans stay standing and as loud as ever. There's no give up. Like, and credit to the Nebraska players who, if Scott Frost is supposedly getting fired or this or that, like, he hadn't lost that team. They played hard against Michigan. But 32-29 for Michigan, I think that the thing is, it was like, this is the kind of game Michigan lost under Jim Harbaugh. Michigan gives up a lead. They don't come back and get it back like in this. They don't get the strip fumble of Adrian Martinez. They get strip fumbled. The other team's final drive isn't chaotic and disorganized. It's theirs, and they walk off looking distraught. This is a different Michigan team. How good Michigan team is? Pretty good. I don't know whether, you know, can they beat Ohio State? Can they win this thing? Still to see. But 6-0, it was a great environment. It was a great game, and Michigan showed everything they had to win it. Their combo of Hassan Haskins and Blake Corum are tremendous. 123 yards for Haskins, 89 for Corum. Hurdling people. Haskins is a great player, and he was a low-rated recruit. I think the only other visit he had was Wyoming. They've developed him over the couple of years. So huge, huge win for Michigan, if only because it just shows kind of a different mindset to this team that you hadn't had in the past, and they needed every bit of it to escape Lincoln.
Yeah, so I was obviously, you know, dueling on my laptop and my screen last night at home watching Texas A&M sort of teeter there late, and then obviously, you know, give Michigan credit, like, in the middle of as difficult an environment as you could play in, they didn't flinch, and that's not something that we can say, you know, about a Michigan team under Jim Harbaugh in every circumstance, right? Like, they went in there, they went into a hostile environment. I had, I picked them to lose, and they stripped Adrian Martinez when it mattered most. And the reaction from Scott Frost on the sideline from that will be an eternal gif. He was just like this. You could see his black wedding ring on his hand. You could just see his hand covering his face. It was just like, we were right there. We were going to do this. We were going to get that, you know, momentum searing win. I think the stat they flashed on TV was he's 0-10 against ranked teams. Everything had happened and everything had aligned. The team had come back. The crowd had stayed. Nebraska was going to make like a last stand for Scott Frost here, and it just all got ripped away on that play when Michigan just stripped the ball out of Adrian Martinez's hand. So Scott Frost remains winless against ranked opponents. Ultimately, I just think that's going to be a big part of the calculus when you look forward at his tenure.
All right. Before we get, you know, we can't move on without this black wedding ring situation that Scott Frost has.
Situation.
I did not know. I mean, it seems kind of ominous, doesn't it? I mean, I'm, you know, I know we're big romantics here on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Like, even for those of us who may not be the most romantic, like the wedding ring, like black, like it's kind of badass. I like that. You know, that I did not know. It's apparently very trendy.
Oh, yeah.
And the black wedding ring. I didn't know about this. Yeah, you know about the black wedding ring.
I've heard about that. I've seen them. Yeah. And I've seen people like getting tattoos now instead of a wedding ring on their ring finger. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff out there now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's dicey. I did not know about the black wedding ring.
Yeah.
Black shirts, defense, black wedding rings. They're just badasses out there in Lincoln.
That's it.
Just badass. Anyway.
Badasses with bad football team. But, you know, that's the way it goes.
There's that.
Hey, give Michigan credit for basically they keep checking boxes on this season. All right? First of all, they're undefeated. But, we watched them and they were really good early on. And then we were like, okay, well, let's see if they can take it on the road. Because they started their first four games, were all at home. You win them all. Well, you go to Camp Randall and you thump a Wisconsin program that has beaten you badly the two previous times, most recent times you played them. Check another box. Okay, well, Wisconsin's not very good. Let's see what happens when they go play a hot Nebraska team with a productive offense. Well, check that box too. They've now, you know, they've done what they have needed to do. We are getting closer. We're going into a bye week now for them. And then they have Northwestern at home, and Northwestern does not look good. We're getting closer to a really big, interesting, fun Michigan-Michigan State game on October 30th because both of those teams have checked all the boxes they need to date.
Dan, will that game get you off the couch? Will that game get you going? I think it's in East Lansing, right?
Yeah, East Lansing.
Well, let's not get crazy. I mean, let's see. I got a lot of things to do on my Saturdays. I can't be spending it all going up there. Now that will be an electric atmosphere, to say the least. So we will see. But you know, speaking of Michigan State, again, talk about checking boxes. You know, they are now bowl eligible in 6 weeks. This is a team with a 4.5 over under win total. They pounded Rutgers, and they did it with this big play offense that was not how Michigan State was really great, at least under Mark D'Antonio. They had good players and they had good plays, but not like this. Kenneth Walker III, 233 yards rushing, had a 94-yard run. Jalen Naylor, 5 catches for 221 yards and 3 touchdowns. How's that for productivity? Big plays beat Rutgers. They're not slogging through. Walker is fascinating to me. He's a transfer from Wake Forest. I saw something. He's like only plus 1,200 for the Heisman. And I know, man, there's some value there. If he keeps this up, these quarterbacks have not, it's not just going to go to a quarterback. He keeps this up and he does this against Michigan and Ohio State going forward. I'm not so sure he doesn't win the Heisman.
Sure.
I mean, he's putting up massive numbers.
Yeah.
And Michigan State is really good, you know, so very, there, you know, you're looking for
We can talk about it this week, but like there's no Heisman. There's nobody that jumps out at me right now. I haven't put a ton of thought to it, but like, there's nobody you can like plant on the ground as the Heisman favorite right now. Because the best players, there's God bless Iowa, but you're not going to put the punter up, right? There's nobody at Georgia's collective defense has him there. Alabama doesn't have that guy. Yeah, so like it's usually, you know, the best player on the best team, right? That's what we default to. So yeah, like this could be the year. Now, it'll be an interesting test of Heisman voters' creativity and open-mindedness. But yeah, this Heisman race has me excited because I have no idea where it's going to end.
I'll give you going in. This is we had this on Yahoo going into Saturday. So this is going in. Bryce Young at Alabama was the betting favorite at plus 150. I don't think that's Ole Miss QB Matt Corral is plus 230. You know, had a nice game against Arkansas, 287, rushed for 94, 4 TDs. He's a great player, but I mean, really? Like that's
I mean,
who knows how many losses Ole Miss is going to have? CJ Stroud at Ohio State's plus 1,000. Bijan Robinson's plus 1,400. Again, that's going into the game. He had a huge game, but they lost. Desmond Ridder plus 1,500. I don't know. This thing is wide open. I think there's some value picks on a few of these guys. And Walker, to me, would be the guy's got 912 yards rushing in six games. Yeah. He's averaging 7.1 yards a carry. Already has nine TDs, four receptions for 30. Let's say this projects the next six and the sledding gets harder. So I'm not going to. But a guy comes in with 1,800 yards and 18 TDs and he's averaging that kind of numbers this year. I don't know. I like that at plus 1,200.
Sure. And that's, you know, that you, Pete's right about what the Heisman calculus has become is like, who are the best players on the undefeated teams or the teams that are in the playoff picture? I mean, if you want to really tie yourself in knots with that formula, which has been the way it goes, then like the Heisman front runner is a nose tackle from Georgia, Jordan Davis, who's 6'6", 340, and is kind of the linchpin in the middle of that defense that's the best in the country. But nobody's giving the Heisman to a nose tackle. So why not somebody like should. Kenneth Walker? Yeah, well, I mean, maybe they should, but it would require a dexterity that Heisman voters have never shown.
Can you get the Riley Moss campaign going, Pat?
Yeah, you know what? Seriously. Although he hurt himself, we'll see how, you know, if he's going to be out, and if so, for how long. But
you know, it would be a year where a defender could rise, right? Yeah, like it's sure. That the field has flattened to that, but Kayvon Thibodeau missed that Ohio State game, and he kind of missed his window. Kyle Hamilton's really a special player at Notre Dame, but they're not good enough, and it's pretty mediocre. I mean, Malik Willis was a name that wasn't on there. He's obviously a quarterback, but I just don't think you almost have to be perfect at that level. He has not been perfect. Derek Stingley is a defender who's like talented enough to be in the conversation. I doubt we see him play another snap for LSU. I'd be pretty surprised. They just announced his injury and out indefinitely, and with his draft stock, that's pretty surprising to see him come back. So, yeah, if your calculus is elite talent and you have to be on a team that has a pulse, I don't know where you go with the answer.
It's going to be interesting, but he's going to have that platform going forward. But his numbers are incredible, and Mel Tucker has got to be in the running for coach of the year. I mean, this is
sure.
We'll see where this goes, but. Nobody, his second year, takes over just a moribund program, works the transfer portal incredibly, rebuilds the team, and has them looking tremendous. One more quick note on Michigan I wanted to add, I forgot from earlier. You were talking about checking boxes, Pat, with Michigan. One of the boxes was, you know, Harbaugh redid his assistants, redid his staff, and he went young. Almost everyone's under 40. They're all, you know, they were kind of seen as recruiters. There's a lot of new fresh blood. They were going to get out there. And the question was, okay, maybe they'll help on the recruiting trail. Maybe they'll do this. They'll get some energy. But can they coach at the level of the older hands? And guess what? They're better. This team is better, performing much better. They're much looser. They're more effective. So that has not been the problem at all for Michigan. That's a box to and a credit to those young guys who came in and got that chance. So I just wanted to add that. All right, a couple more results here that have some implications. Boise State ends the BYU conundrum, beats a top 10 team for the first time in since 2010, 26-17 in Provo. That pretty much should end the big debate of like, what do you do with BYU if they win all these games? Because they were going to have, I think, 7 or 8 Power 5 victories if they did that. 5 over the Pac-12 and a good Boise State program. So they're pretty much out of the national title chase. Cincinnati takes care of business on Friday night over a bad Temple team. The more important result was an epic Notre Dame Virginia Tech game that unfortunately was on the ACC network, so very few people saw it, but was very dramatic. Notre Dame wins, and man, Cincinnati needs Notre Dame to be 11-1 to win these debates as this goes forward, because you know that's their win. So that little bit of the thing, can a group of five team get there? Makes, you know, just adds to that thing. I still think it's going to be tough sledding for Cincinnati. I do not think undefeated just gets them in. They're going to need help. They've gotten a lot, but they're going to need more, and they really needed Oklahoma to lose the other day.
Yeah. No, they sure did. That result hurt them. But that, yes, if you're Cincinnati, you know, like your hierarchy of needs are, first of all, yes, win all your games. Secondly, root like hell for Notre Dame to win all the rest of their games. If Indiana wins more games, that's also a bonus. And then you probably need an Oklahoma loss. You certainly, it would be fine if Oregon loses another one. If some of these Big Ten teams knock each other off and you just start clearing out some of the competition so that at 12-0, even with a schedule that is okay but not great, you have a little bit of cushion there if you get to 12-0 and eventually 13-0.
Yeah, Oklahoma's interesting going forward because they are a wondrously flawed team, as we've seen in a bunch of different ways this year. And I really think all of a sudden a big date on the calendar emerges that we would not have expected before the season. And I think it's that Oklahoma game at Baylor on November 13th. Baylor very quietly is 5-1. They thumped a good West Virginia team. Dave Aranda went 2-7 last year. They should be ranked when the rankings come out this week. And their loss was at Oklahoma State, where there's no shame to lose. And obviously, Oklahoma has to go to Oklahoma State at the end of the year. But I really feel like that Baylor game all of a sudden gets exponentially more juice than any of us would have imagined before the season. Baylor hosts BYU this week. That is arguably one of the five biggest games in the sport this weekend, because you have Kentucky, Georgia, obviously that's where game day is going to be headed. And then you have BYU will be ranked. Baylor should be ranked. That's a top 25 game. So I just think that Baylor has just very quietly, because of modest preseason expectations, slid under the radar, and they're going to be a problem going forward. They get Texas the week after at home. Or I think there might be a bye. But they have consecutive home games now with BYU and Texas, and it'd be an interesting opportunity. I mean, Baylor, it wasn't that long ago, they were playing for the Big 12 title under Matt Rhule. They were in the national conversation, and props to Dave Aranda for, going through a year of tumult, figuring it out, connecting with his team. Hiring Jeff Grimes, the OC from BYU, worked out really well. That'll be an interesting subplot this week. But I really think that becomes a huge obstacle for Oklahoma. I don't think this Oklahoma team is good enough to win in Waco and in Stillwater. I have a hard time imagining this Oklahoma team running the table. They might just be now.
They got a new QB.
Sure. That defense, though.
Yeah.
We'll got to tackle somebody.
Final result, and we'll get to the other stuff. This podcast may be going. This could be like 2 hours long right now, and we could go another two. Auburn hosts Georgia. Cam Newton shows up. A shirtless Bruce Pearl shows up. Okay. Doesn't help. Bulldogs roll 34-10, setting up that huge game against Kentucky. Georgia's like your one safe bet right now. Like, it's your one thing you can count on is Georgia. And that game, we'll talk a lot about that Kentucky-Georgia game as the week goes on, but didn't want to just avoid the one team that just took care of business. I mean, beating Auburn like that at Auburn in that environment is an impressive victory. This is not the Cam Newton Auburn team, but they aren't that bad, so. Good on Georgia.
Right now, Georgia is way ahead of everyone else, I think, in terms of quality of body of work at this point. It is not close between first and second.
Yeah, and the eye test and every other test you can come up with. So
yeah.
When their worst result was beating Clemson right. by only a touchdown, you're doing pretty well. We talked real Heisman, but we don't like to wait. Let's hand out some small sample Heismans. Who's got one?
Hello, record book.
Hello, small sample Heisman.
How about that?
Having been at Iowa and seen them win, there's only one person I can give the small sample Heisman to, and that is their punter, Torrey Taylor. The Australian punter. I remember a couple of episodes ago, Dan was very disappointed to find out he wasn't like from Altoona or Ankeny or whatever, but it was actually from Australia. Yeah. But the guy is an absolute stud. He's a big, strapping dude, 6'4", 231. And he can, he can punt with power like the Aussies do, but he's just lethal with his location. Hits those backward spinners, and he just over and over and over kept pinning Penn State down there. And that was a huge key to winning the biggest game that Iowa's hosted in a long time. It is just, it's a very, very Iowa thing that they love the punter. The punter has an NIL deal for gear, sweatshirts, and t-shirts that says punting is winning, and there's nowhere else you would have that but at Iowa. And the Iowa fans at one point,
you better have bought one.
I will. They weren't for sale at the stadium, so
okay.
But
A lot of hate on punting now. It really is.
Yeah,
They're getting the bad. Punting's not cool, except that
I know. We got a, you know, the coach at Presbyterian who's gotten a career out of not punting. But sometimes punting works, and it's working for Torrey Taylor and for Iowa. The Iowa fans at one point were chanting MVP at the punter, another thing that only happens at Iowa. So Torrey Taylor, small sample Heisman, coffin corner kicker extraordinaire.
All right, Pete?
I am going to go to a overlooked story, which is USC losing its third consecutive home Pac-12 game. Like, somewhere Pete Carroll's hair turned even more white. And I'm going to give my small sample Heisman to Cameron Rising, the Utah quarterback who just obliterated the carcass of the USC program. He completed 22 of 28 passes. He had 3 touchdowns. He had no interceptions. And Cam Rising, who is California native, went back home and just absolutely sizzled in the Coliseum on Saturday night. And how sad is it for USC that they get blitzed on their home field? And I mean, they had to score 16 in the fourth to even like just not get obliterated like they were some, you know, Mountain West chum invited in for an early September game. So yeah, Cam Rising, Kyle Whittingham, that I don't care. If you're at Utah and you can roll into the Coliseum and run them, that has to feel really, really good. So props to Cam for lighting up the Trojans.
All right, Sully, you're going to love this. Giving my small sample Heisman to Hendon Hooker.
Ooh.
Tennessee quarterback, 17 to 23, 225 yards, 3 touchdowns. This was a team affair. Tie on Heaven's Rush for 119. Hooker also ran for 66 yards. Tennessee is rolling in a way we weren't maybe expecting. It's not the greatest team ever, but they put 62 up on Missouri. They put 45 up on South Carolina, and they got Ole Miss coming up, which I think is going to be a really interesting game, and then Alabama after that. So Tennessee Vols look dead in the water after the Florida defeat and the Pitt defeat. Their offense has rallied, and they're doing some pretty good things. So I will give my small sample Heisman to the Volunteers. All right, we said a lot of mean things here this week, although the games were so good, we weren't really as bitter as normal. But still, we could always be nicer. Can we say something nice? Pete Thamel, can you say something nice?
Well, I wanted to say something nice about UMass, Dan, but I'm going to allow you, for all the generous donations you've given to your school, I'm going to allow you to say something nice. So
now
I am going to pivot to the opposite end of college towns, and I'm going to pivot to old friend Brady Hoke. Brady Hoke has reborn his career in San Diego. What a place to do it. The Aztecs are 5-0. They're in first place in the Mountain West. They blitzed New Mexico 31-7. And, you know, this is the rare microwaving of a coach in a program that's worked perfectly. Brady Hoke has gone back after losing at Michigan, gone to San Diego State, where he was a winner and built another solid, consistent winner. So the Aztecs have not beaten enough high profile teams to get in the CFP conversation. And really that, you know, New Year's Six conversation is hard to weasel your way into now too, because Cincinnati's kind of running away with that. But they blew out Arizona. They've beaten a good Utah team, and they are just kind of rolling, and good for that program, which obviously is trying to make a statement to the Big 12. So props to Brady.
Yeah. Doing a ground and pound style there. They're a physical run play defense kind of team. I'm going to say something nice about Iowa, because it was my first time going to a game there, and everything about it was phenomenal. I mean, the atmosphere was great. The fans were phenomenal. The Iowa wave was really touching to see everyone doing it, including the Penn State team, including the officials. Everybody turned and waved at the Children's Hospital at the end of the first quarter. It's one of those very cool, you know, extremely unique traditions that's blown up, and it's a feel-good moment for sure. And then even I got to go beyond that, just from a media perspective, like Iowa, this is a huge game, but they took care of everything extremely well. They, you know, everything worked right, and then post-game, we got probably at least 6 players, and they boom, 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 running them in and out, and, you know, they did great with that. And then Kirk Ferentz stood there and answered questions for so long that I was like, I got to go. I've got to go write this story. And Ferentz at one point said, because like people were tripping over each other trying to ask him questions, he said, hey, I'll stay here all night. What do you guys need? And so, you know, there's plenty of coaches you don't get that from. And I understand he's feeling good after a big victory, but it was a all the way around. It was just a good show on a big day that went off really, really well for Iowa.
All right. Well, I guess I got to say something nice about UMass. So I will. If one of you picked them first, I was going to say something nice about UTEP. My other favorite. I didn't go to UTEP, but I have a kinship with the old Texas Western school, which is now 5-1.
It's amazing. It's
pretty amazing. Dana Dimel took over an 0-12 program, went 1-11, 1-11, 3-5, and now 5-1. Their only loss is to Boise, playing great football down there in El Paso. But I will say UMass, the UMass-UConn game, neither team had won since 2019. Walt Bell, their coach, had one victory in his career at UMass, that one his third season, and that was over an 0-12 Akron team back in 2019. Last year, albeit they only played four games, the Minutemen scored 10 points the whole season. Actually, 12 points, 10 offensive points, and a safety. That was their a 12-point season. Now, granted, small. They're playing a UConn team, which is epically bad. The game becomes comic fodder, worst game, you know, maybe ever, all this different stuff. UMass wins the game, whatever. Someone had to win. If you're UConn, man, UConn's interim head coach had COVID and couldn't coach the game, of course. Like, I mean, Eric couldn't make it up. But this is what makes college football great. UMass wins. Their student body, who, God bless them, came. Some of them came to the game. Storms the field. It's a little more of a like a gathering at midfield than maybe like the Texas A&M storming. It was like some guys waiting for the bus like in downtown Amherst. But they storm the field. The players celebrate like they won the Fiesta Bowl. They get in the locker room. There's video of this epic celebration. And you know what? That is what makes college football great. The worst game of the year, the worst game in years, it sets off this great celebration. And God bless it. They work hard. They lifting weights. They're doing all this stuff. They never win. They finally win. Hell, have a great night. I loved it. I love when you get that kind of a celebration on a game that is just otherwise embarrassing. So great job, my UMass Minutemen.
Is that going to spur you to make a donation? Are we now? Is it going to get you off your wallet?
No. Like I said, I was educated very well there to know you to make money, not give them money. So no. See how nice their locker room is?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
That thing looked pretty sweet.
They have a nice
football
facility. I've been there, and it's a very nice football facility. The first time I walked in, I was impressed. Part of this job, you go to a lot of football facilities, right? And everyone wants to show you the weight room, right, Pat? Let me show you the weight room.
Let's show us
UMass,
that thing.
Yeah. UMass facility is very nice. Here's my question, Dan. Do you think it was more crowded at midfield in the moments after the game or at Antonio's Pizza at 2 a.m. with the
post bar? Always Antonio's. Hot cheese up front. Yeah, no, it's got to be a pecking order.
How far is the stadium from like the dorms where everybody lives?
You can walk it.
Okay. So I wonder if maybe like fourth quarter, they're like, hey, we're going to win a game. Let's go over there. Let's go run on the field.
It's not like Alabama where it's like the campus.
Yeah.
Like you drive through, like, oh my God, look at the size. It's like dwarfs the president's house is like right next to it.
Yeah.
Like Brian Denny, you're like, oh, that's where the president, where's Nick Saban live? He lives in that big building. You could totally go to the game.
I just wonder, if they walked in the fourth quarter, like, hey, we're going to win. Let's go run on the field.
They might have. Yeah. I'm sure hopefully they open the gates. Good place to social distance. Anyway, good for that. Absolutely incredible Saturday. So we tried to, we got through some of the games. We couldn't get through them all, but we'll get back more on, we'll be back on Tuesday with our regular podcast and later in the week with a Race for the Case. Please continue to listen, share us on social media, spread the word, tell your friends, and leave us nice reviews. We've had record listenership for months now. It just keeps going up and up and up and up. But, We're free. You get what you pay for, and we can take more. So we'll take them. So we will talk to you later.